Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite our historian community to exert their power over the public discourse. The podcast where myth and misconception is crushed under the colonial jackboot and the sun never sets on the truth. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and for this final special for the Gloucester History Festival, I am thrilled to welcome Oxford Professor of Early Modern English Literature and Culture, winner of the British Academy Book Prize for Global Cultural Understanding, and author of Courting India, England, Mughal India, and the Origins of Empire, Nandini Das. Nandini, welcome to History Rage.
Thanks, Paul. It's really good to join you on this.
Thank you very much. You did mention in your email that you're excited about getting angry.
Oh, well, any excuse for that, I think. Any excuse.
We are providing a valuable service here to the historian community. So before we dive into actually what you're here to rage about today, you're a first time for History Rage. It was your first time in Gloucester. It was only my second time in Gloucester. Could you tell us a bit about your background, your work, how you got into this particular field, and your latest book, Courting India, and what it's covering?
Absolutely. I trained as a literary scholar, and in fact, my teaching at Oxford is at the English faculty. And I work mainly on the 16th and 17th centuries. What I'm really interested in, however, within that period, is in travel. Now, this is the period when England suddenly realizes that sitting in a little island is not going to cut it. So English ships start going on out across the world, you know, doing a little random bit of looting here and there. I say little, but not quite.
Yeah.
Establishing a colony, wiping off a few settlements of native inhabitants, the usual thing in a day's work for a would-be imperial nation.
Yeah, it's pretty much the norm for 16th century Europe, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the English are really aware that they're kind of, you know, latecomers to the field. The Portuguese and the Spanish have really set out the route for them. So that's the period I'm interested in. And particularly what fascinates me is how different cultures interact with each other in this period, both mm-hmm. within Europe. So Englishmen going to Italy, for instance, and writing about Italian cities and food and all kinds of stuff. But also people from abroad coming to England. And by that, I don't just mean Europeans coming to England and going, ooh, it's all a bit old-fashioned here, isn't it?
And cold.
Because, of course, England is about 200 years behind in terms of what we know as the Renaissance, the rebirth of culture.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, people from all the way across the world, for instance, you know, Japanese sailors, Native American princesses, and the odd random Indian woman brought up in the Islamic Mughal harem who happens to be married off to an English adventurer, or that's a, putting it kindly, con man.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. So you hear them promoting Courting India. So what's the sort of depth of that we're getting into today?
Well, we're plumbing the depths of my anger here, Paul, because Courting India was written out precisely of that frustration. As I said, I'm really interested in how people interact between cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really frustrated me when I started looking at the very earliest contact between England and India, India is where I come from, where I was educated initially before coming over to England, is that it all seems to start around the 18th century.
Yeah.
And the whole story seems to start with, oh, you know, the British Empire is already there. It's a preformed entity. And there we go, off to India, doing the usual random bit of looting and pillaging, establishing railways. Railways always comes into it.
Yeah.
And off we go with that story. But I'm the kind of person, perhaps, who annoyingly wants the backstory to that main story, the one who watches out for the prequel. And there wasn't any of that in historical writing, or where there was, it was very deeply hidden in the archives somewhere or in scholarly articles.
Yeah.
So Courting India is the story of that very earliest moment, the point where British Empire really isn't a guaranteed thing, not a winner, shall we say.
Okay, so we'll dive into that and get into the further questions then. We'll kick off with getting your rage specific rather than the themes that you've hinted at there. So what is the one thing you wish everyone would just stop believing?
Putting it...
You don't have to put it mildly. You can put it angrily.
You're egging me on here.
Of course I am.
It's difficult to put it in a nutshell, really, because it is so prevalent across our public discourse around empire. The thing that annoys me, really, is an assumption of how the difference in power worked between the two nations.
Yep.
Between England and India in this period. And by difference in power, I mean the assumption that the British Empire was politically, economically, financially savvy and strong enough to establish its base and retain that base in the Indian subcontinent for a couple of centuries, and that India was already fragmented and broken and therefore could be exploited. So the reason that annoys me is because if you look in the archives and you step beyond the point where histories of the British Empire usually begin, which is around the mid-late 17th century, and you go a little bit earlier, the picture is completely different.
Yeah.
And that bit is so conveniently forgotten about.
So what's there at the time then? You know, if we have... It would be very easy to have this idea that we do have, that the British Empire just turns up, plants its flags around, draws on its various colours of guns and goes, hello, we've got a colony. We're British. We're going to take over this bit. We're going to move up into the hills where we can grow tea. And there you go. But so what sort of country, I wouldn't even say the British Empire, what sort of country is there when the East India Company turn up there and kind of start this whole thing off?
Well, let me set the picture then. So imagine two countries or two nations in this period. One of them is pretty much on the verge of bankruptcy and is deeply fragmented. The ruler and the ruled nation don't speak the same language. They don't understand each other. There is deep anxiety about religion, religious persecution, all kinds of things going on. You know, the first cash for honors scandal, we can come back to that later. There's a kind of trade crisis. There's disease. You're guaranteed to get some kind of serious gastroenteric fever or disease pretty much every summer. And that's England in this period. When Elizabeth I dies, and James VI of Scotland comes to the throne in England, he's pretty chirpy about it because, of course, he thinks, I'm going to take over the English crown, I'm going to unite Scotland and England, and it'll all be hunky-dory.
Oh, no.
Neither country is having it.
Mm-hmm.
Both countries go, union? Not really. Don't fancy that.
There's still some now that don't fancy that.
Well, certain things do not change. I mean, there's a deep division between the two nations at this point, between Scotland and England, and James is straddling both. Both countries are unhappy. Both sets of courtiers are unhappy. James has a huge headache because England's finances have been drained in defense, essentially. Remember, there was the Spanish hovering on the doorstep for about 50 odd years before this. And there's been the Spanish Armada and all of that. A lot of resources have gone into that. So James comes to the English throne thinking, oh, there'll be loads of money, and there isn't. And then he has a terrible habit of giving loads of expensive presents to his favorites, which doesn't help with his bank balance either. And in general, English trade has taken a nosedive because, of course, England has broken away from continental Europe.
Yep.
And that means all its trade agreements have been kind of shot to pieces. So what do you do when you have that state of affairs? You kind of turn to the global south for new trade agreements.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening in this period. On the other side of the world, of course, is the Mughal Empire in northern India.
Yeah.
So we are not even talking about the whole of India, modern India at the moment. If you think about that triangular shape of the Indian map,
yeah,
we are talking about just the northern part. But that, of course, includes large swathes of what is now Pakistan, Afghanistan, various other places.
Yeah.
And the Mughals, who are an Islamic empire, fairly new, 1520s, they were established in India. They were also invaders. But they have, by this point, got pretty much assimilated, quite deliberately assimilated into northern Indian cultural and political life. They're also stonkingly rich. I mean, they're astonishingly rich, which helps. It's because they are tapping into trade routes that have existed for centuries. I mean, when we talk about, you know, silk and spices and stuff, if you think about European historical perspective, and this, by the way, is another point of rage for me.
I knew we'd get you going.
You've got me started now. We tend to think of it as something that starts with the Portuguese, but of course it doesn't. Trade had been going on in these areas for centuries before even the Portuguese landed, and the Portuguese had landed 100 years before the English landed. So at this point, the Mughals are a very close second runner-up to Ming China in terms of control over global trade. So there are four huge empires, none of them are European, which control global trade. There's the Ming dynasty in China. There's the Mughals in northern India. There are the Safavids in what's modern-day Iran or Persia.
Yeah.
And there's the Ottomans in what's now modern-day Turkey, but spread across that Mediterranean region, essentially. So by the time the story that I tell in Courting India starts, which is around 1614-ish, you have a very, very different scene to what you might expect. You have a huge, rich, affluent, very civilized court. And on the margins of that court, you have one man standing with a petition. He's got this strange thing on his head. Now, this court recognizes that Europeans have a habit of wearing such strange things on their head. They call them kulaposhan, or sieve wearers. It's like you're wearing a, you know, the thing that you drain your pasta in on your head. And this man is the first English ambassador to the Mughal court. He's been sent by James I and by the East India Company, which is fairly a new starter. It's a startup at this point. So it's been sent, it's been lobbying for ages, and now it's managed to send an official ambassador who wants a trading license. So that's the point of starting of Courting India.
Okay. So we're starting then with this startup, the East India Company, and the various bits of instability at home. So at that point, like you say, it's a startup. And the one thing, I've started several things, this being one of them, and the one big swinging thing that kind of always occupies your mind is the uncertainty of the future. You know, so how uncertain was the future of the East India Company at the outset of Courting India? And what contributions, and what factors are contributing to that?
That's a really good question. I mean, in the sense that uncertainty is pretty much what defines it at this point. So, imagine that most of the foreign investment that England makes in this period is basically made by a small group of very, very rich merchants who all occupy a fairly limited amount of space in the center of London. Nothing, again, quite changes.
No, not really, no.
So there is this small group of merchants, most of them very rich, and they're investing across the world because they're desperate to get their hands on some of that stuff that the Portuguese and the Dutch have got, spices and rich cloth and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But also, their own export is English wool. And of course, they can't sell it to continental Europe because continental Europe has pulled up the drawbridge, essentially, against them. So they're desperate to find another alternative market for English wool. I mean, you could say that someone should have told the Tudor bros rather than the tech bros that India in the middle of summer is probably not the best market for English wool. But hey, who are we to complain about
exactly. that? If we can see if we can sell it to like Greece and southern Spain, I'm sure we can sell it to India.
Exactly. So there's this small group of merchants, but of course they've put their money in multiple pots, and that money isn't enough. So that one uncertainty is getting essentially enough money for every voyage to go out. You know, you can't just send one lot of ships out. Mm-hmm. And say, right, that's it. That'll settle me for life. No, you have to keep arranging a rolling investment.
Yeah.
So they have to depend, shock horror, on what the English are really the innovators of at this point, which is a joint stock trading company. Yeah. Now, this is very different from what the Portuguese were doing. The Portuguese were being rubber stamped and bankrolled by their king. Essentially. Mm-hmm. So it was a state-owned enterprise. The government bankrolled them.
Yeah.
None of that. I mean, the government in England does not help the trade at all. It would gladly take a cut of the trade profits.
Again, nothing changes.
But actually helping with it? Nah, not so much. So what they try to do every year is get money from ordinary people. If you happen to be a shoemaker or wine seller or a ballad seller in London and you have a spare shilling or so saved up, you could invest it in the East India Company. And if the ships came back, then you'd get a profit. And if you were really lucky, the profit could be pretty eye-watering. It could go up to about 200% returns. Yeah. So it is really the equivalent of taking a high-risk investment in the stock market these days, particularly because sea voyages were so risky. Of 10 people who might go out to on an overseas voyage, maybe 3 would come back.
Really?
So it's hugely risky in this period. So there's that uncertainty. Money. What would fuel the ships that you're going to sell? The second uncertainty is those pesky Portuguese and the Dutch again. So the Portuguese are really concerned about the English entering this market because, of course, they, till this point, have been operating particularly in the Indian Ocean region. They've had quite a cushy protection racket going. So basically, what they would say to the Asian ships taking that Red Sea route for trade is, now look, there are a lot of dangerous ships out there on the high seas, which would rob your ship. And by dangerous ships, we mean us. But if you give us a set amount of money, tell you what, we won't rob you.
Yeah.
We'll protect you from us. So that's a pretty lucrative protection racket for them. And that's above and beyond what they're getting from trade. So, of course, they don't want another seafaring nation to come and say, actually, we can undercut them and we can protect you from them. And that would also get us to heaven because we don't like Catholics. So the English quite like this idea of attacking the Portuguese, but they're also deeply aware that as I said before, they're about 100 years late in establishing their basis. Mm-hmm. in India, the Portuguese have already got working relationships with the governments and the states and the port officers and all of those people in the western coast of India. So there's infrastructure, finance, infrastructure. The third thing, and this is the thing that gives my man Roe, the first English ambassador, the biggest headache, are the English themselves. They just can't work together. They're constantly arguing. The big bosses in London do not want to listen to the experience of the people lower down on the ground.
Yeah.
The people lower down on the ground are constantly getting drunk and fighting with each other. Neither party gives any attention to the poor ambassador who tries to kind of pull them together. It's like herding cats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there you go. Any British diplomat will tell you.
Absolutely. And uncertainty is the theme for, you know, the theme for the day, the flavor of the month.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So how do they go about dealing with that uncertainty and turning it into the East India Company that we would think of today then?
Well, it didn't initially. And this is the thing. I mean, if you look at the archival records, and there's a lot of archival records, because if there's anything the East India Company did well, it was paperwork.
Yes.
They loved their paperwork.
And historians love a bureaucracy, don't we?
We love a bureaucracy. I mean, I have never been so fond of an expenses report as I have been when I've been looking at the East India Company paperwork. Now, when I file in my own expenses reports, I feel like I'm doing a service for the future. But going back to what I was saying, if you look at that early paperwork of the first, say, 50 years or so, they're pretty much constantly packing their bags every other week, ready to ship out of India.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't know how long they can stay. It is so uncertain for them because they don't have the trading licenses with Mughal India. They don't have the infrastructure. They don't work together. It's a huge problem for Thomas Roe. When Thomas Roe is sent, he's sent as a joint employee of two masters. James I sends him as his ambassador, but the East India Company is much more interested in him getting that all-important trading license, or as the Mughals called it, a Farman. But for the next 80-odd years, the East India Company is never going to be a guaranteed thing in India. And this is the bit we tend to neglect, because it's after that, once the Mughal Empire starts kind of self-imploding in a way because of political machinations, that they can really establish their bases in India. But that won't come for another century or so.
Yeah, so we are at this point then 100 years plus before what we all think of the East India Company as being.
Absolutely.
Which neatly then leads me into my next question then, where we can get a little bit more detail on that, I imagine. So what role did local Indian rulers, their particular power structures, play then in shaping both the expansion and the influence of the East India Company?
So India at this point is a nation that has also multiple political states.
Mm-hmm.
And that's slightly weird, I think, for us to get our heads around. In Europe, the closest you could think about in this period that is an equivalent is Italy, which is a lot of city-states.
Yeah.
But still, for people external to those city-states, it's seen as a single entity. So the English would talk about the Italians. They wouldn't just talk about the people from Florence or the Milanese. Yeah.
Would a good parallel here be like ancient Greece, where you talk about Athenians and Spartans and Corinthians? And
yes, absolutely. That's another kind of comparable to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Parallel, perhaps. So at this point in India, you have multiple kingdoms across most of southern and eastern India. But I suppose the major entity is the Mughal Empire,
yeah,
which rules over about 150 million square miles, a huge mm-hmm. swathe of country. But there are multiple languages, multiple cultures, multiple religions, even within that. Now, when the Portuguese had arrived over 100 years before the English, they had set up shop, literally set up shop, on the western coast of India, in Goa, mm-hmm. and in the surroundings of that. The Dutch, whose arrival roughly coincides with that of the English, focus further down towards southern India.
Yeah.
So the English at this point are trying to figure out where to kind of set down their roots. And the place they choose is a port in western India called Surat. And their idea is that they'd put their ships in Surat and then travel up north towards Agra and Delhi, what we now call the Golden Triangle, you know, the usual tourist routes.
Mm-hmm.
Center focus for Indian foreign travelers in India. And that's exactly what the English traders do. They would stop the equivalent of the tourists today flying in perhaps to Bombay and then traveling up. In this case, they would take their 6 to 8 month voyage, come to Surat, and then travel up to the Mughal Empire.
Sure.
And then negotiate with that empire. And the Mughal Empire at this point is a hugely developed, for the English, rather annoyingly overdeveloped bureaucracy. Well, the Mughals, who were, of course, as I said, themselves new to, they weren't indigenous mm-hmm. to the subcontinent. They had come from the north. What they realized pretty quickly was that they couldn't impose a monolingual single religion rule over the entire subcontinent that they were aiming to rule. So what they started doing was that they would allow independent kingdoms to pay them a tribute
mm-hmm.
and rule as they did before. And that meant keeping track of all of these different districts and kingdoms and councils with a huge amount of bureaucracy. So as soon as the English arrive there, they get caught up in this huge swathe of bureaucracy and ritual and courtly culture. They are absolutely flummoxed by it. To some extent, it's surprising why they should be flummoxed by it. Because, of course, bureaucracy is something that the English held dearly to their hearts, even in
yes.
Tudor and Stuart England in this period. But they probably didn't expect that same level, and they didn't expect to have to conduct it in a completely different language, of which they among themselves had very few interpreters.
Yeah.
So annoyingly, they had to depend on Jesuit priests, so Catholic priests
from
Portugal or Italy. They did not like that, to translate for them. So they were paranoid that, you know, their message wasn't being put across or the wrong message was being put across. And Mughal bureaucracy kept stalling them as well. So it was a huge mess right from the beginning.
Yeah. How long did it take them to actually get like the trading licenses sorted out?
Well, they actually, Thomas Rowe was in India from 1614 to 1619. He never managed to get what he wanted, which was an exclusive trading license. In other words, he wanted a license that would allow him to kick the Portuguese out of India.
Right.
But you asked me earlier whether the local kind of government or the political powers realized how they could exercise agency
mm-hmm.
and negotiate with the British. The Mughals certainly did, in the sense that they were absolutely averse to giving a monopoly to any European power.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at the archives, you can see them, ever so gently playing the two off against each other, the Portuguese and the English, at various different points. Because why would you? Why would you allow one maritime nation to take over the seaport in your own empire? It just didn't make sense.
It goes against the very spirit of trade, doesn't it? You want to trade with as many people as possible.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that you've got all these different kind of independent kingdoms and things like that that have got the Mughal Empire over the top of them, plus that you've got the Portuguese and you've got the Dutch. And I imagine that you've got, you know, people in India that are not part of the Mughal Empire as well. Again, we do know that the East India Company is going to expand out into the kind of organism that we think it is. Can we talk a bit about that balance of power in India and how the politics and power and influence shift between East India Company, Mughals, Indian rulers, factions, British government, you know, that whole melting pot? That could be quite a big answer, I know.
Yes, it will. Let me try to paint the picture for the period when Roe is actually in India against that context for you. Mm-hmm. So Roe knows that if he wants to get a trading license, he needs to get it from the Mughals. Now, where does he get the trading license for? His bosses back home want him to focus on Western India, on the west coast of India.
Because that's what they know. Where the Portuguese
are. Where the Portuguese are. And that's why they know about that bit of India. So they want their own slice of that trade. But I mentioned that the Mughals themselves have a lot of internal bureaucracy, a lot of internal political intrigue as well. And in fact, the power behind the throne at this point is, apart from the Mughal emperor himself, and in fact, even more than the Mughal emperor himself, are two people. One is the Mughal emperor's favorite wife, his 20th wife, an astonishingly competent woman called Nur Jahan, and the crown prince, Prince Khurram, who will later become Shah Jahan, who builds the Taj Mahal.
Right.
Later on. So what the English very quickly get caught up in is this almost kind of tug of war of power between Nur Jahan on one side and Khurram on the other, the crown prince on the other. So the crown prince fighting against his stepmother, essentially. Yeah. So the crown prince is the person who is responsible for giving trading permits to Western India. So that's fine. Roe goes off and starts petitioning the crown prince. The crown prince doesn't give him the time of the day. Roe grumbles about it in his reports back to his bosses back in London all the time. Then he cottons on to the fact that actually I should be talking to the ladies. In fact, to the ladies through their middlemen, essentially, to the empress. And there's a wonderful letter by Roe where he writes to his bosses, the governors of the East India Company back in London, and says, I've just been talking to the brother of the Empress Nur Jahan, and he tells me that actually in Eastern India, there is a place where we should be aiming to set up shop rather than in Western India. And he names these two kind of smaller settlements, which is where all the fabric, the famous Indian fabrics came from. So this is the point where the ports in Eastern India that essentially dealt with China and Myanmar and all of those regions.
Yeah.
The Asian trade routes. And of course, the governors, his bosses back home completely ignore him. It's going to be about 200 years later that they come around to actually, well, maybe there's something in that. Let's establish a base and call it Calcutta. So it'll take a long time before the British Empire actually comes to that stage. But at this point, Roe is pretty much negotiating with anyone who will listen to him. He's waiting for the Mughal.
Sounds like not many people that will as well.
Well, that is the minor fly in the ointment for him. There is one amazing point where he's following the Mughal Emperor, who is about to attack And the Mughals have been waging this long war against the kingdoms of the Deccan Plateau, which is the middle triangular bit of India, if you think about the modern map. So off goes Roe, following the Mughal emperor's army as he's about to attack the Deccan, and the Deccan forces are being led by an African general called Malik Umbar. And while being in the Mughal emperor's kind of retinue in his procession, they're camping in the same place, Roe sends a messenger to Malik Umbar's fort asking him if he's interested in buying a few weapons. Oh, this is playing a very dangerous game.
I don't know. He's getting into that Mughal spirit of playing one off against the other, isn't he?
He's also getting into a very dangerous ground of arms sales, and you don't want to go there when you're not sure about where the political fortunes are going to lie. But here's the thing. For the first 80 years, and this is what I keep going on about, you're bringing me back to my rage again. Yep. For the first 80 years of the East India Company's life and activities in India, Roe is not the only one to keep writing back saying trade and colonization, or trade and politics rather, are completely incompatible. Don't even think about establishing permanent settlements in India. This country is too huge, too complicated, too stubborn for you to be able to do it economically. It's just going to be really pretty bad for business. It's expensive, this colonization malarkey, essentially.
So lastly, to round up then and say, so what are the, if you were to say the, like your main things that you would like people to take away from this, what is the idea that you would like the public to go away with? And what is it from your research that has really nailed down the idea of the monolithic British Empire being, you know, ridiculous?
Two things, I think, in answer to that. The first is that very bluntly put idea that the British Empire was not a given from the beginning. The success of the British Empire, even its existence, was not a given at this point. The power dynamics worked very, very differently. But the second thing, I suppose, is that a lot of assumptions about India, assumptions that would carry on for the next 400 years, and in fact are still assumed quite often now, the seeds of those assumptions were established by those first travelers like Thomas Roe. Because, not because they spoke from a position of cultural superiority, but because they spoke from a position of cultural insecurity. So imagine you are the representative of a very small island that no one has heard about, and you come to this enormously rich empire, as Roe did. You look at the grandeur and the magnificence of that empire. You know how beyond your grasp that is. One way of tackling that, indeed, as Roe did, would be by saying, oh, this is all a bit too much. It's too over the top. It's too bright and garish. Whereas in England, we're all pretty muted. I mean, muted because, of course, bankruptcy, that's a factor. But, you know, pretty muted. It's classier in some ways. Not in so many words. Translate that into kind of early 17th century diction, and you have Roe's attitude down to a T. But those assumptions about the extravagance, about the over-the-topness, about garishness, are still part, to some extent, of common cultural perceptions that have framed English views of India now. So that's my second thing about questioning where those perceptions come from.
Well, thank you very much for that, Nandini. Do you feel better having got that out of your system?
I do indeed. Thank you so much for giving me that opportunity for venting.
You're welcome. And you are welcome to come and vent back anytime if you feel that it has been therapeutic for you. Well, if you would like to know more about this subject, then you can and should get yourself a copy of Nandini's book, Courting India. We will have that links to that in the History Rage bookshop, as well as links to the books of everybody that we featured in the festival. And if you want more insights, you can follow Nandini on social media at Ren Traveler, and we will put a link to that in the show notes as well, because people just have unpronounceable Twitter handles here. But once again, Nandini, thank you very much for sparing us the time to do our final Gloucester History special. It has been an honour.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I would really appreciate any reviews you'd leave for us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel. And if you're loving this, then please support The Rage on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, you'll get early episodes, entry into all the prize draws, invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until the next time, from everybody that's been involved with the Gloucester History Festival, I'd like to give a massive thank you to all of those people. I'd like to give a massive thank you to all of you who have listened. Till next time, stay angry. Bye-bye.